Hello and welcome to this edition of the Rank the Albums podcast, the podcast in which I review classic artists and rank their albums from worst to best. This time I'm looking at Simon & Garfunkel, who released five studio albums between 1964 and 1970, and I'm not going to be counting their live albums or their soundtrack to The Graduate in these rankings. Now, the advantage of this discography is it's short, and their five albums are also short, with an average runtime of around half an hour. So anybody can get through their entire discography in about 2.5 hours, which is a huge advantage. Known for combining their sweet, saintly harmonies with deft melodies and dark lyrics that appealed to college students, and only to college students, their work ranges from the haunting and alienated to the wistful and the easy listening. They never drift too far away from the folky singer-songwriter genre, and their discography is usually seen by critics as inferior to Paul Simon's solo career. Now, I tend to disagree with this. I think his solo work, while still very good, is a little too mature, too subtle, maybe a little too laid back for me. He kind of misses out on Art Garfunkel's harmonies and his strong lead vocals. And with Paul Simon's lyrics, he doesn't quite strike me as being the tenor of the times as he is with his 60s work with Garfunkel. Simon & Garfunkel actually started off in the 1950s as Tom and Jerry, who were kind of bubblegum teenage rockers who had some crap singles and failed to really make a mark. And they put their dreams of stardom on hold for a bit to do the responsible thing and get a college degree, before reforming as Simon & Garfunkel, playing their early songs in folk clubs in New York City and in Greenwich Village. And it was there that they were spotted by Tom Wilson from Columbia Records. Now, Tom Wilson is a hugely influential figure in 1960s music. He was Bob Dylan's producer on several of his albums. He was instrumental in creating the electric folk rock sound of Bob Dylan's Bringing It All Back Home album, and then the Like a Rolling Stone single. He later got Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention signed, and he had a major hand in producing the Velvet Underground too. So he's a huge unsung hero. Before all that, he was instrumental in getting Simon & Garfunkel signed to Columbia. And I'll go on to explain why this wasn't how Tom Wilson gave Simon & Garfunkel their big break. I give all this as context because the first album I'm picking is their first album. As my number five pick is Wednesday Morning 3 AM from 1964. This was recorded in the March of that year and released in October 64. And it's an album very much performed in the folk, choral, gospel traditions. It features only a handful of Paul Simon originals. Does a cover of Dylan's The Times They Are Changing and a few traditional tunes. Most performances only feature the duo harmonising with Paul Simon's acoustic guitar, finger picking away. There's a double bass that kind of plucks away, stomps away on a few of the tracks. Bleecker Street and the title track, which concerns a burglary of a liquor store, are pretty good. The original incarnation of The Sound of Silence is on this. It's interesting, but it perhaps lacks the eeriness of the well-known electric version. And it's right in the middle of an album that has quite similar sounding tracks. According to Greenwich Village folky Dave Von Ronk, Simon & Garfunkel were kind of laughed out of town when they performed The Sound of Silence in folk clubs because it was seen as so inauthentic and preposterous. And it was maybe in this bid for seriousness that the world wasn't ready in 1964 for Simon & Garfunkel. Yeah, overall, Wednesday Morning 3 AM is a pleasant and mellow listen, but you can see why it didn't set the world alight. It doesn't have the missteps of subsequent albums, but it really doesn't have the heights either. So yeah, the first album bombs. Paul Simon moves to London to pursue a solo career touring folk clubs in England. And he releases an album called the Paul Simon Songbook in 1965 too. And the songs on that album form the bulk of Sounds of Silence, the next Simon & Garfunkel album, as well as a few tracks on Parsley Sage, Rosemary and Thyme, the subsequent album. And the Paul Simon Songbook is all acoustic. It's very pleasant, it's very good, and it's got some classic tracks on it, but it's very weird to to hear it, because Paul Simon's such an unsuccessful artist at this point, and these songs would become very well known in subsequent years. My number four choice is Sounds of Silence, released in early 1966, released only a few months after the Paul Simon songbook, but actually by this point Paul Simon's fortunes had significantly improved pretty much overnight. And that all came about because of Tom Wilson, the producer at Columbia Records I mentioned before. He was convinced by the hit potential of The Sound of Silence, and he remixed the track and overdubbed his signature folk rock sound, the jangling electric guitars plus the steady bass and drums. And infamously, this song was released without Simon & Garfunkel's knowledge or permission. But the song was a hit, and it led to the Sounds of Silence album after Simon & Garfunkel hastily regrouped. This album was rush recorded in late 65, released in January 1966. And the sound of the album, as you might expect, isn't far removed from Dylan's electric sound. And there's no doubt the duo are jumping on the folk rock bandwagon and became one of the leading lights of the genre, almost by accident, really. Actually, I'm not sure to what extent they decided to jump on the bandwagon. I think Tom Wilson and the record label threw them on the bandwagon, as it were. But for a rushed album, The Sounds of Silence is pretty consistent. All the songs are Paul Simon originals, with the exception of the instrumental Angie, which was originally by British folkie Davy Graham. Blessed is a pretty decent stab at folk rock. It's a blatant rip-off of The Byrds. I Am a Rock, the final track, is a great anthem for loners. Somewhat more dated is Somewhere They Can't Find Me, with its mid-60s bluesy electric piano, fuzz bass, Morricone-esque strings and trumpet. We've Got a Groovy Thing Going is, as the title suggests, a very similar 60s-sounding track. And I think Simon & Garfunkel first formed their reputation for being somber wrist slitters on Richard Corey and A Most Peculiar Man, which are sequenced back-to-back on the album, and both contain protagonists who commit suicide. Kathy's song and April Comes You Will, these are quite similar finger-picking songs, very tender with pretty melodies. And overall, this album is a big step up from the Wednesday Morning 3 AM album. And one of the sticking points with these rankings is the question of which album Homeward Bound is on. Reputedly written in a railway station in the town of Widnes, it's a great single that was featured on the UK release of Sounds of Silence, but is on the US release of Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme. This is due to the fact that in the mid-60s, many album track listings weren't synchronised between international releases. On the CD reissues that I've grown accustomed to, Homeward Bound is not on The Sounds of Silence, it's on Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme, so I treat that as the canonical discography. And that's part of the reason why Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme is my third pick from 1966 again. This one is much less reliant on the Paul Simon songbook, and it's a result of 3 months in the studio, which at the time was quite a long amount of time to spend in the studio, especially for a group who were completely unknown the year before. And consequently, the album is more considered, more refined. It's a self-assured record. The track listing shows their aptitude for light and shade. You have the carefree, breezy 59th bridge song, in brackets Feeling Groovy. And that's sandwiched between two very different tracks, between the sneering Dylan-esque rocker, the big bright green pleasure machine, which takes aim at capitalism and the advertising business, and then the delicate orchestral breakup song for faux intellectuals, The Dangling Conversation, which is both gorgeous and precious. It somewhat clumsily illustrates a couple growing apart by detailing their reading habits. You read your Emily Dickinson and I my Robert Frost. For Emily, Whenever I May Find Her is a stunning tune, but once again it has ridiculous try-hard lyrics about crinoline and juniper. The opening track, Scarborough Fair, is bewitching, with choral counter harmonies, twinkling glockenspiel and anachronistic harpsichord. There are criticisms of this album. The lyrics on this are way too showy and pretentious throughout. You have to roll with it and think, oh, you know, it's the 60s, but I do think there's a shift after this album where Paul Simon writes with more subtlety and maturity. This album's quite stylized and precious, more so than any of the other albums. It's sometimes a bit frustrating to listen to this album because its themes and lyrics are so rooted in what was happening in the mid-60s. A case in point, the album ends with a delicate version of the Christmas standard Silent Night, which also has an overdubbed television news report about the Vietnam War with Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon mentioned. It hints at the innocence and experience themes of their next record bookends, and I'm sure it struck an effective contrast at the time, but it sounds very rooted in its particular moment. Another track, which is very 60s, is a simple desultory philippic, or How I Was, Robert McNamara'd into submission. And this is a kind of a Dylan folk rock parody, despite them being a folk rock band. And it has kind of a roll call of 60s references. With this album and Sounds of Silence, you do sense they were perhaps constrained a little by having to conform to folk rock trappings, a genre Simon manages to skewer and satirise quite well on this song. With future albums, they sound a bit more comfortable and in control. But despite these scruples, Parsley Sage, Rosemary and Thyme is a consistent and varied record. Most of the tunes are strong. It has interesting production tricks throughout, and they sound incredibly distinctive by this time. All of the criticisms also highlight how unique Simon and Garfunkel were at the time, in that they were devoutly bookish and proudly on rock and roll, not afraid to be seen as literate, satirical, fey or vulnerable. It's arguably more consistent than my number two choice, but it doesn't have its high points. At number two is their final album, Bridge Over Troubled Water, released in 1970. And by this point, they're not a cult band for college students, and this album certainly has way more mainstream appeal. It's got a lightness to it, although the start of the album is quite misleading in this respect. It starts with the power ballad title track featuring Art Garfunkel's finest vocal performance, and then also the enigmatic El Condor Pasa, which is based on a Peruvian folk tune. But then the rest of the tracks, yeah, there's an acceptance of simpler lyrics and more tasteful arrangements, which entirely suit them on this. They're not trying to be overly arty or experimental like on the previous two albums. And I think this easygoingness is what struck a chord and made this album such a big hit. That's not to say it's an entirely safe album. With The Boxer, it kind of combines their intimate, folky finger-picking in the verse, and then there's this big, expansive chorus with echo drums, brass and string, and harmonica embellishments. It's a tale of poverty with hard-hitting lyrics such as the following verse. Asking only workmen's wages, I come looking for a job, but I get no offers. Just to come on from the whores on 7th Avenue. I do declare there were times when I was so lonesome I took some comfort there. But the verses are sung with such sweetness and wistfulness, it gives the song a real mysterious quality. The Lie 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 chorus is a matter of some dispute. Is it supposed to be wordless vocalising, or is it Paul Simon pointing out that this story is a fabrication? He said it was a placeholder lyric, and one he's embarrassed by, but this does seem to be uncharacteristically lazy. It's considered one of Paul Simon's best tunes. I can never make up my mind about whether I agree or not. But the bombastic chorus, particularly towards the end of the track, makes this a real standout of the record. Other highlights include the lush, airy melancholy of The Only Living Boy in New York. And you also have positive, catchy and timeless melodies of Cecilia and Keep the Customer Satisfied. I like the delicate bossa nova of So Long, Frank Lloyd Wright. And the tender, orchestrated finale, Song for the Asking, combines classical elements with country elements, and it rounds off the album nicely, if a little sentimentally. And this album does have some weak moments, particularly on the second side. I don't really gel with Baby Driver, and Why Don't You Write Me has a kind of awkward country and western reggae hybrid. So these songs are acquired taste. And then there's a quite innocuous cover of the Everly Brothers' Bye Bye Love, taken from a live recording. And it's a nice tribute, but there's this, like, this tedious and loud cowboy yee-hawing in the audience. And it makes it hard to listen to. But I can't mark it down for its weak songs, considering the quality of the great songs. The title track, in particular, is a compositional masterpiece. And I think the countless cover versions obscure how clever and dynamic the original arrangement is, building up to that astonishingly powerful climax. Bridge Over Troubled Water is the least miserablest of their albums. It's accessible, even if it's veering towards the middle of the road tendencies of Paul Simon's solo career. And it's also stylistically varied. It delivers great pop tunes like Cecilia and The Only Living Boy in New York. So it is my number two. So that leaves one more album, that is Bookends, released in 1968. So I haven't entirely gone in chronological order with these albums. So just to give a bit of background to this album, between Parsley Sage, Rosemary and Thyme, and Bookends, Simon & Garfunkel contributed to the soundtrack of The Graduate in 1967, and that heightened their countercultural credentials, and with particularly Mrs. Robinson, they had a huge hit from that. So Bookends was a hugely anticipated record. 1967, same year that the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper, of course, and that has a significant impact on how both artists and consumers perceive the album format. It encourages many artists to develop concept albums and spend more time crafting albums. And indeed, Bookends took a lot of time to make. A lot of the arrangements were worked on meticulously with John Simon, who had produced songs of Leonard Cohen and went on to produce the band's first two records. And Bookends is a definite example of Sgt. Pepper's immediate influence. Side A is a conceptual suite covering life from birth to death, and Side B is mostly singles, mostly accessible but unrelated pop tunes. Side A starts and ends with the Bookends theme and its reprise. It's comparable to Pink Floyd's Animals. It has a comforting short song that kind of bookends the more troubling material in between. And the tender, soft guitar notes of the Bookends theme are rudely interrupted by one of the first uses of the Moog synthesizer on Save the Life of My Child. Supposedly played with the assistance of Robert Moog himself, it's a truly nasty-sounding synth. Unfortunately, the song isn't really a synth banger. It's just kind of used as like to create this jarring, discordant cacophony of, and the song has lots of like sampling of smashed glass and cracking percussion hand claps. It has this stabbing, sliding bass and reverb-drenched gospel choir. There's also a sample of the first lines from The Sound of Silence thrown in just for good measure, and the song follows a group of people who are in panic as they try to stop a child from jumping off a building, I think is the premise. So that's why the music is deliberately head-spinning and bewildering. On balance, it never gets as thrilling as that dark, gurgling synth sound at the beginning, which is kind of thrown in for effect rather than the basis of the track. The next track is far more sure-footed. It's the sweeping, epic track, America, with its themes of the possibilities of youth, the possibilities of America, and the creeping doubts and disillusionment that young people might have. It has this quite a waving, meandering verse melody which builds to its anthemic chorus. It's a very dreamy, hushed song, apart from these big booming drums that punctuate the mix emphatically. And these are no doubt influenced by Ringo Starr's drumming on A Day in the Life. America is followed by the brief, wistful ballad Overs, which covers the same ground as The Dangling Conversation, in that Paul Simon is exploring how relationships grow stale. Although Overs is a more subtle, light-hearted and less overwrought song. Voices of Old People is a very literal title for what is 2 minutes of recordings that Art Garfunkel made of people in an old people's home. And it has a similar jarring effect to the synth in Save the Life of My Child. 1 minute they're talking about a relationship slowly stagnating, and the next it's straight down the old folks home for you, as if you didn't even notice the rapid passing of time. I do think this is an unusual move for a countercultural band, but I think it fits the album's themes really well. And it's only 2 minutes long, but it's also, yeah, pretty thought-provoking. Voices of Old People also predates the interviews and voices of ordinary people found on Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Voices of Old People eventually seeks nicely into the track Old Friends, which is the first side's second centrepiece. An orchestrated ballad, it's got a desperately poignant melody and lyrics. The orchestra aches with nostalgia and also seems to get lost, confused, and it ends up rambling. It's like trying to evoke the state of mind of a very elderly person. And then there's the reprise of the Bookends theme, this time featuring lyrics. And it goes, time it was, and what a time it was. It was a time of innocence, a time of confidences. Long ago it must be, I have a photograph. Preserve your memories, that's all that's left you. And I love that line, that's all that's left you. It's suggesting memories are not what's left of you. They are the things that have left you altogether. I also like how there's a remembrance of times of innocence, but the previous tracks have covered the darker side of life, from suicide attempts to existential doubt, failing relationships, and then the merciless passing of time. He seems to say, nostalgia, what nostalgia? All the tracks on the first side seek and flow into each other really nicely, and they obviously wanted to create a very cohesive suite of music. And Bookends is actually quite similar to Kate Bush's Hounds of Love album, in that one side is purely conceptual, and then the flip side delivers the hits. And it's interesting that Simon and Garfunkel saw the late 60s vogue in producing a conceptual album, but also had the good judgment of not trying to stretch the concept beyond its value with filler tunes. And they judiciously put the heavy songs on the first side of the record with songs people knew and loved already on the B side. The decision to include the previous singles was also partly down to Paul Simon's writer's block rather than actual design. So with the second side, you get much more fun, breezy, less conceptual but more focused tunes. Faking It, which was initially released in 1967, is bluesy and swinging, with a great chorus and a subtly psychedelic intro and outro rhythm that's very influenced by Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles. Punky's Dilemma is an outtake from the Graduate soundtrack, with a lilting melody and a soft staccato rhythm, ostensibly Paul Simon singing about and extolling the virtues of Kellogg's cornflakes, English muffins and boysenberry jam. And it's very soft and twee, but the chord changes are also quite sharp and angular. The mention of Vietnam War draft dodgers and Mary Jane do complicate the song, suggesting it's more countercultural and drug-inspired than it first appears. And its meaning is left to be quite open and impressionistic. Incredibly, Punky's Dilemma was worked on for over 50 hours in the studio, despite being such a light throwaway song. The last three songs of Bookends are a fantastic ending salvo. You have Mrs. Robinson, which became a hit for the band in 67, driven by twanging, shuffling acoustic guitars. The rather cutesy vocals are ironic considering the adulterous subject matter of the Graduate film. And the song doesn't bear that much relation to the plot of the film. It seems to be from the point of view of a shrink talking to the titular character. But the themes of middle-class respectability and morals like the film are prevalent on the song. Next up is the irresistible Hazy Shade of Winter, which again is riff-driven and melodic. It was actually recorded for the Parsley Sage Rosemary and Thyme sessions in 66 and is one of their best folk rock tunes. At the Zoo rounds off the album on a light-hearted but infectious note. Paul Simon said, Bookends was our first serious piece of work. And I think that's a little harsh on the previous three albums. But I do agree that there's a general sense of confidence and purpose, a lack of filler, a great deal of consideration in terms of the arrangements, and incorporating subtle inventions in their sound and writing songs that were strong, full of meaning, but also varied. Bookends has a great sense of playfulness, and clocking in at just under half an hour, it's very economical. That's not to say it's not flawed, the fact that tracks like Overs are over before you've even noticed them sometimes feels a little dissatisfying. But most of the time I mainly want to listen again and again to pick up the little details. Since only half of it is a concept album, you can say that it's a half-baked concept. I think that's a very fair criticism. But I think this is the album that I come back to the most. It's their most consistent work. It's paced really interestingly throughout. It's full of great contrasts. And although I wouldn't place it among the very best albums of all time, I certainly think it's one of the best of the late 60s. So yeah, as I say, Simon & Garfunkel's discography is very easy to complete. Of course, a lot of their best tracks were the singles, so nobody could be faulted for just wanting to listen to the greatest hits, but their albums are also very, very enjoyable and very consistent, and people should check them out. And that's all for this time. Thank you very much for listening again. Until next time.